I quit comedy again. That's what's coming up on the Autobombing episode 262.
My friend Dan, he's got a podcast, cause all comics need a podcast, and nobody had a podcast called The Art of Bombing. So Dan went out and bought a tape deck. Who knows why he bought a tape deck? Podcasts don't get played on tape decks, but Dan is from the 80s. So hey there, all you funny jerks, come talk to Dan about your work. Tell him all about your worst times. It's The Art of Bombing.
Welcome to a brand new episode of The Art of Bombing. I am your host, Dan Bublitz Jr., and with me as always is my co-host, co-producer, cohort, Mr. Josh Shirley. How are you doing, Josh Shirley?
Let me tell you something, Dan. I remember last week when I came on the show and broke down one of my worst all-time shows that had happened weekend before.
You almost got beat up because you harassed a 13-year-old girl that was in a bar.
Right. Okay. Time
Okay, Bomb Squad. You're just wait for this. Bomb Squad, that's what we call our fans. So get ready for this. Is this going to be the same craziness as last week?
Get ready. Yeah. Get ready. Well, I think we ought to just back it up a little in case this is somebody's first episode and clear up. Just kind of clean up a little spill here and say.
Of me talking about 13-year-olds at bars.
Saying I accosted a 13-year-old. That's even worse. I mean, people would believe that you would do it.
Oh, hey now. You know. Hey, I mean, now. This is not a roast show. What are we doing here? But that was a great burn.
Yes. Well, yeah. Just go back and listen to the episode.
That's right. Episode 261.
261. You'll hear the whole story. I did not accost a 13-year-old. Now, some things played out.
It was really a misunderstanding.
A big misunderstanding. It was a not that funny episode of Three's Company.
Yeah, exactly.
And
wrong place, wrong time.
Well, I came out and I told Dan the whole story. And this time, this past Saturday, I had my best show of all time.
Ooh. So like the opposite.
Dude, it was two just completely polar opposite.
Oh, that's amazing.
I can't believe it. I went to a small town in the middle of Kansas. I announced it on a previous show that I was going out there. I was featuring for Bryce Stanley, a Midwest headliner. He's all over the place. He's in St. Louis, Kansas City. He's in Springfield, Blue Room. He's all over the place. And he takes me out there, and I do 30 to start the show. So I have some. So it's funny, in this episode, we're going to talk about how great it is to be the feature spot and like all the great things that sort of come along with that. And I got the time limit, you know, the amount of feature time I had to do, but without the benefit of going in the middle. So I had to come out and do a little bit of crowd work to get it going, and then just completely destroyed the place from there for 30 straight minutes with all of my jokes were hitting. I rely on a lot of callbacks to make my jokes work, which, you know, is good and bad.
And if you're not familiar with comedy, in order to make a callback work, you need to make sure you do the setup to the callback.
Yeah. As Dan likes to do.
Not to do. Dan likes to skip the setup.
Yeah. And then, so that's what happened to my Aunt Sally. And everybody's like, dude,
I'm like, what? I like the pressure of that moment in my brain when I'm about to do a callback, that moment when I realize I didn't do the setup, and then I have to like throw an audible. I like to put that pressure on myself.
Yeah. Take the microphone and stuff it in your mouth. Like it's a great feeling. Yeah.
Although, I don't know about you though, just real quick, something that as I've gotten better as a comedian, I have been able to do that where I can throw an audible in there and work in the setup and then come back to what I was originally going to do so I can still get the callback in. It's, you know, it's more the callback comes sooner than it would normally, obviously, but I've been able to like do that audible.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you're
and still make it work.
You've messed that up enough times where
I got a lot of I got a lot of practice.
So I know we got to get into today's show, but I'll just wrap up by saying, so it did not sound like it was going to set up well. He's like, look, it's a benefit for an athletics department at a school. So I'm like, great. You know, typical comedy's not the main reason. I walk in there. There's 150 people ready for jokes. We sit down. They fed us. We ate, had a drink. Got up on stage, and these people wanted some comedy, man. They were ready to go and had a great time.
That's awesome. That's great to hear. I'm glad you had a good show.
Yeah, man. It was just,
you got your redemption.
I did. That's a lot of people we have on this show say that. Like, I have a bad show. What do you want to do to get over it? I got to have another show.
Yep.
So I needed that. I had that feeling, and definitely it hit. All pistons firing in Centralia, man. It was fun. Big crowd. And I really kind of was able to prove a lot to myself.
That's great. That's good to hear. I'm glad that it went well. I got to love that. You got to love a good redemption story. I'm just glad you didn't almost get beat up for harassing a 13-year-old at a bar.
That's right. That's right, guys.
That was like my favorite part of that story last week when you were like, the dad came up to you and like started in on you. And I'm just like, yeah, but does he know he's at a bar?
Yeah, I know.
Like,
I
why does he have a kid at a bar?
Because it was so frustrating.
Because it's the Midwest. That's why.
Exactly. Well, yeah. I mean, you're not like, she never should have been in there. She's bigger than my wife. I mean, from
that
from
was
the
probably
crowd.
My favorite part when you said that, when you're like, I didn't, she looked bigger than my wife.
Yeah. That's, I mean, she did. She looked like a grown, and I'm like, you know, I've kind of filtered any idea that anybody in that bar with a glass bottle, nonetheless, it's going to be younger than 21 years old. And it's on them to make sure that that's the case. That's our verbal contract between us and the
that's
venue.
Right. Exactly.
You do your job. You make sure that you follow the law and have of age people in the bar. And that's exactly why.
And I'll make sure I do my job and make them of age people laugh.
That's right.
I love it. Well, this week we have another great episode. Chris Grace is on the episode. And if you don't know the name, that's fine, but you should, because not only is Chris a fantastic comedian, he is a fantastic actor. For me, this was a fun episode to record because I'm a little bit of a fanboy. So Chris Grace is an actor and comedian. He played on a reoccurring guest role on one of my favorite sitcoms. You may, for those listening, you probably know NBC's Superstore. Chris plays the reoccurring role of Jerry. Just a funny character. For me, this was great because I was just like, I'm a fanboy. I loved what you did here. I was so excited. I did this episode at Snow Jam. We were a sponsor of Snow Jam Comedy Festival. Obviously, I'm also a co-producer of it. And he was one of the comedians that submitted. I was so like shocked that he submitted. And of course, he got in because he was a funny comedian. Had one of my favorite sets of the weekend. Full disclosure, as a producer, when you're running things, you don't get to see a lot of the comedy, but I did get to see one of his sets, and it was just amazing. He did it at a magic shop, and he got somebody from the audience to come out because he bought a magic trick from the magic shop.
Oh, nice.
And then did it during his set that night.
Way to be in the room, Chris Grace.
Right? And he brought somebody up who was funny, too, because the person he brought up was also wasn't on the festival this year, but was a local comedian. So of course he was all about hamming it up and playing into the person from audience. So it ended up just being really good. It was like one of the highlights of the festival was watching him do this at the magic shop. But nonetheless, that's who our guest is this week. I was super excited to have him and talk to him. And I will say, there's a lot of differences between me doing this episode with Chris and when I did the episode years ago with Alonzo Bowden. You can tell that I'm more professional now.
All right.
Because if you listen to the episode with Alonzo Bowden that came out like when the first year of this podcast, I was a major fanboy. I was not on my game with the pro like that. He held the episode. I should be the one holding the episodes.
But there really was an episode with Alonzo Bowden, right? This isn't a callback to something that never happened.
No,
right?
there really was. There really was. Okay. He did one of the early episodes. I don't remember off the top of my head which episode. It was like within the first 30, if memory serves me right. A big fan of the show, Lee Bruns, who's another fantastic comic from Watertown, South Dakota, big fan of the show, big supporter of everything we do. He actually put me in connection with Alonzo, and we ended up doing the episode. And I was a big fan. I'm big fan of Alonzo. And back then, I didn't really know what I was doing, you know, as a podcaster. So you can tell that I was nervous to have this conversation with him. And I was kind of fanboying. Not the same situation with Chris. Chris, we just talked like comics because I've grown as an interviewer and a comedian, but I was still very excited. And you can tell I'm fanboying right now because
yeah,
we did
you're
the podcast.
Still, yeah, you're still going, dude.
I am. I won't shut up about how excited I am that Chris Grace did this podcast. And I think that with that, we should just get into this podcast. Here's our conversation with Chris Grace. Enjoy.
And now. It's time for the stand-up soundbite.
I'll let you all in on a secret if you promise not to tell anybody. I'm 49 years old. Yes. Almost about to receive the AARP magazine and enjoy it. People don't believe me when I tell them my age because I have the face of a baby. But that's okay because I have the body of a baby. That's okay. I have the financial stability of a baby and the emotional maturity of a baby and the arthritis of a 49-year-old. I am an actor. I live here in Los Angeles. That's my way of telling you that I'm gay. Been on television a little bit. I consider myself mildly famous. That means a third of you might recognize me from TV, a third of you have no idea who I am, and a third of you think I work in your company's IT department. Yeah, I'm a gay. Sorry, ladies, I'm gay. I am married. Sorry, boys. I'm married to a white man. Sorry, ancestors.
It's the art of bombing.
So you flew in last night. You got in last night, late last night.
Yep, got about 10 p.m. last night. So, first, of course, I'd like to record a podcast as early as possible the next day.
That's, yeah, and I suppose, too, because you flew in from L.A., there's that.
It's wrong time zone, Dan.
I know. It's really early for you. I forgot all about that. It's for me, it's just like regular morning, but for people in California, it's super early.
Yeah, exactly. And also, it's the dark of winter.
Yeah, well, hey, that's what we do in this podcast. We put comics in, like, the worst possible scenario.
Yeah. Now, will people know that I'm here for the Snow Jam Comedy Festival?
Well, now they will. They'll know that this is what it's for. This will come out way after the Snow Jam Comedy Festival.
This will come out when there's sun in the sky as opposed to this festival that is leaning into the...
The name, yes.
Yeah. Well, I like that a lot of people will schedule their events sort of counter to the seasonal cycle of wherever their town is, you know, because that's when it would be easy for, but not you. You're like, you know what? Let's put it in.
Let's incorporate it.
We're on a day when I looked up, the high is 25.
this is one of the warmer years. Yeah. I was just talking to another comic that I ran into in the breakfast room, and they got in. They were here last year as well. And they said, yeah, it was actually, it's a little bit warmer than it was last year. Last year, Lord. I got off the plane and it was like in the negatives. it's like 25 degrees is great.
If that had happened last night, I might have just turned around and been like, can I ride this plane back to LA?
Are you originally from California, or I mean,
I'm from Texas.
Originally. Oh, okay, but so still warm areas.
Yes, exactly.
Because yeah, I grew up here in South Dakota, and then I lived in California for a while, and I got real weak when it came to the cold, real quick.
Uh-huh.
I got accustomed to that nice Southern California weather.
Yep.
And I remember the first time I came back for a visit, I stepped off the tarmac. It was like in December, and I was like, I want to go back.
Yeah.
So I can feel your pain on that.
Yeah.
So did you do any shows this week? And are there certain clubs that you prefer performing at in L.A. area?
Well, this week I had a show. I'm hosting a monthly show at UCB in L.A.
Oh, nice.
That is, depending on when this comes out, may or may not still exist. I started a show that's a showcase for comics to do new material. So
oh, nice.
It's, so, you know, in America, we have the strong, like, open mic scene.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the open mic scene is what is, you know, I mean.
Yeah, it's an open mic.
I don't want to, like, I think we all know that the open mic scene is extremely positive and not toxic at all. But I did some shows in London, and I talked to some comics in London, and they don't really have the same thing. They don't have a culture of like
an open mic scene,
not quite the same way, right?
Okay.
And I was talking to some like pretty established comics there. I was like, so what when you're coming up, like, what is the how do people do it over there? And he's like, oh, and what we have these things called new material nights where like we'll just and even established comics will use them, which is like, I just want 10 minutes to work on this stuff. And they have more of a philosophy of like, I wrote 10 minutes. Let me go try it a new material night. So it's like an established showcase. Like people pay to come see these shows, but the audience knows that it's new material. So it's slightly different.
So it's marketed as new material.
Right.
But it's not marketed as, oh, this is just an open mic. Anything can happen. It's like,
exactly.
It's a little more controlled. We know, you know, the people on the lineup are, you know,
yeah.
probably established. And,
yeah, like the last, the one I did this week, I had Robin Tran and Lori Kilmartin did the show. And
oh, nice.
They did new stuff. Like, you know, it's a neat idea that, like, there aren't that many shows like that.
No.
Where,
I know they do that in Nashville, too, at the Zanies has that same kind
yeah.
of thing, new talent.
So they're, they
new,
got the
not new talent.
They're
new.
Covering the East Coast.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. They're more. They're well. Actually, aren't they more central? Because they're in the one is Nashville is more.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I live in L.A., so everything's East Coast.
Everything past the California border.
This Sioux Falls is in the East Coast, right?
Pretty much from California. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. But yeah, I've seen that they do. They do one on like Mondays or something.
Yeah. So I had that this week. I hosted that this week, and that was pretty much it. Otherwise, I was just taking care of stuff at my house, and I don't grind as much as I used to. I think. For whatever reason, I don't. It's either true that I don't feel like I need to grind as much as I do, or it's just a lie I'm telling myself because I'm lazy.
Maybe it's a combination of both.
I think that at a certain level, and I think this also goes hand in hand with like coming up through open mics, and I think comics maybe fetishize a little bit too much, like how many the sheer quantity of sets that they do in a week.
Yeah, I agree with that. A lot of comics want to, you know, they think the higher the number, the better they're doing for comedy wise. You know,
yeah.
They kind of evaluate their career or their, you know, as their level as an open mic or based on how many mics they're doing. Which
yeah.
You gotta look at
it comes from a
quality too. I think.
I think it comes from a good thought, which is that which I'm experiencing directly, which is that there is something you get from experience that is sort of inarticulable. It's really, you can't really say like what skills you've earned over 1, 3, 5 years that for whatever reason you're better than you were. And so I think it's sometimes comics want to like fast forward that part, but I don't know if you can.
Yeah.
I don't know if doing 11 sets in a week is better than doing 6. Six even sounds like a lot.
Well, does it, yeah, right?
I think that's contrast that with like, I think if you like you're in New York City and you're doing 11 like paid sets in front of audiences. That's different.
Different. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I agree with that. I also think quantity of time too, like, because I've tried to put that in perspective to other comics too, where, you know, there's, you know, when I was living in Minneapolis, there was a open mic that just outside of the city. It was like about an hour. It was in another town. But if you came from out of town, they'd give you a little more time. And they didn't have a lot of comics show up. You could get even more. And I know one time, you know, they were giving comics that were coming down from the cities 10 to 15 minutes. And and that same time in the cities, there's an open mic, but it's 3 minutes a comic.
Yeah.
I always told comics, I was like, well, I'd rather go down here, because going here and doing 15 minutes is the equivalent of going 5 weeks there, and I'm getting that 5 weeks in one night.
Yeah.
So then you got that. I feel like quality of time.
How did that fly with comics when you told them that? Did they believe
some
you?
Of them? I mean, some of them, when I talked to them about it, it gave them a different perspective because they didn't think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of comics, I think we get short sighted, and again, we think of the end goal of I got to get as many sets in as possible.
Yeah,
and so that's all they're thinking about, just going up on stage, but they're not thinking about the quality when they're on stage. And I think for, you know, people like you who are producing shows like this, you know, New Material Night is huge, because comics that are coming and doing that, it's more of a quality, you know,
yeah,
quality experience, and it's gonna give them a better evaluation of their material versus just doing it at an open mic, you know.
I have a question for you, since you're doing a lot of road stuff, because I think what challenge that I have now is, now I sort of would love more opportunities to do, I mean, even at an open mic, I would love more chances to do like this doesn't exist, but like 15 minutes to, because there isn't really a smooth path to go from, hey, I'm doing a bunch of like 8 to 10 minute sets.
Yeah.
Like 8 to 10 minute sets, I can do, like, I pretty much, I've nailed it, guys.
Yeah.
No, but you know what I mean? Like,
I totally know what you mean. Comfortable especially doing, if you're in LA, because, you know,
everything. National headliners are doing 8 minute sets.
Exactly. There's because in the Midwest, you know, and even, you know, I suppose New York's closer to what it's like in LA, but are in the respect of the showcase style or whatever. But out here, you know, we have showcases, but we also, most of the shows, comedy shows out here are traditional, where it's, you have an MC, feature, and a headliner. You know, out in LA, headliners, again, they're doing 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's a headlining spot. Out here, it's a 45 minute to an hour spot.
Right. So I guess since you don't live in LA, you can't give me advice. But I was going
to
say,
I lived in Southern California for a while. I can relate to it.
Well, what I was going to say was that it's like, one thing I've learned through this is that there's a transition from every level to the next.
Yeah.
Like, and it's kind of different for each one, because now I would say the challenge is like, you know, I need to have basically an hour for stuff, right? But like, there's not that many chances in town for me to like work that muscle, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, to be honest, I think the answer is going to be like, I'm just going to kind of book hour-long slots and like start working them. And like, you know,
I think it's, you either got the issue of, it's one of the things, you either have to just start booking hours and going with it, or, and it, start booking half hour, you know, the feature spot.
Yeah,
but I think, you know, somebody would, and because I was going to ask this too, you know, because you're also an actor, you've been in quite a few popular things. People are, you know, you're definitely recognizable as an actor.
Yeah.
And so that gives you, you know, you have established credits. So that's one thing that helps with drawability. So you can go right into that hour.
Right.
And so you've got that going. But, you know, as a feature, it's kind of hard to want it like, oh, I've got all these credits, come in and do a half hour, and then you're opening for somebody nobody knows. You know what I mean?
Well, the thing is that I would love a run of going around being I don't care about like being a feature for someone, because, by the way, like, all my friends who have gone through this path are like, the feature spot's the best spot.
It is. Well, it is.
Right.
I'm not dogging on
the feature
spot.
No, I'm just saying
it's just harder for you to get to that hour because you're only doing a half hour.
Right. But to take your point, like, I actually do think that the bookers that I talk with, they already do want me to like be the headliner because of what you're talking about. Because it's easier for them to market, which totally makes sense.
Yep.
But it also means I'm skipping the phase that everyone enjoys and getting to the phase that everyone is like, because there's more pressure and there's more.
Oh, there is. Absolutely.
Because, you know, I already feel it a little bit with some of the stuff I've booked where I'm like, okay, if you book me to come headline at your club, which, you know, I'm comfortable with material wise. I'm comfortable. Like, I would love to get more chops in terms of like actually, but I'm confident that I can do the hour. Right.
Yeah.
But it means I'm skipping right to the stage where I'm like worrying about like, well, how many people are going to draw? What marketing should I be doing? Like, I'm already.
Oh yeah. You got that added pressure.
Yeah. It's like, I'm already becoming a corporation. Like I want, you know, people like, you know, stand-ups that are past headlining, you know, people with Netflix, like a Netflix special every year, they reminisce lovingly about the times when they were a feature,
where they didn't have to do anything.
They got to go around with no pressure, do their favorite 15-20 minutes of stuff, and then got to like leave the stage. You know, like they got to, and they're, you know, they're always like, you know, I crush, and the opener, the headliner couldn't follow me and stuff like that.
Yeah,
it's like, I mean, the only drawback about that is that, like, you know, I think even with today's economics, like if I for featuring, it's like, oh, I'm not going to make any money this weekend. I'm just going to break even to fly somewhere or you know what I mean?
Exactly.
The numbers don't make sense.
No, they don't. Not at all. Even working the road, they don't make sense. I've scaled back doing as much road work as I was doing because it's like, well, you know, if you had to drive somewhere, and a lot of these road gigs, you know, especially the one-nighters, comedy, you know, the club circuit's a little different because usually they'll put you up and, you know, give you lodging and stuff like that. But a lot of these one-nighters are not even providing lodging. And they want you to pay your own, you know, for your own lodging. You got to pay your own gas. You got to pay all your, you know, all your expenses. And then they give you the same amount of money that they were giving in the 80s. It's like,
yeah. One of the first gigs that I was offered in this, sort of, like I was telling you before we recorded, like I sort of picked up stand-up again during lockdown. I was sort of working out the numbers, and they wanted me to come to, I think it was St. Louis maybe, but and it sounded like a super fun thing to do. You know, but they offered me a certain amount of money, and I was just working out like flight, like I was going to have to pay for flight and hotel myself. And then I was like, hey, can you pay me a little more? Cause I'm, you know, to like package all that together.
Yeah.
And it was like, it worked out basically like, do I want to pay negative? Do I want to like earn negative $200 to do this,
to do this gig?
To this gig. And, you know, I mean, and I, I'll tell you, like, the reason I didn't do that gig was I asked for like $200 more and they never got back to me. And I'm like, okay, so maybe that was a red flag to like not deal with you.
Oh, yeah. Especially because of the no communication.
Yeah. Because, everybody has the right to like ask for a better offer, and like I'm totally fine with someone being like, we can't afford it, sorry. Oh, and then I'll make my own decision about whether I'm taking it or not. But if I push,
you
got to
know your worth too. Yeah. I feel like that's one thing I feel like too, we're going, you know, talking about open mics and comics wanting to get up on stage. They get so desperate to be on stage that they don't ever think about their worth, and they just say yes to everything, and then suddenly they're homeless. You know what I mean? Because they're taking and I think that's, you know, that's a great strength to be able to kind of know your worth and then have the power to say no or make, you know, or to say yes or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny because I got the offer for that thing, and it was like really the first time someone sort of out of the blue like said, hey, do you want to come do this gig? And I texted my stand-up friends that I started with in New York City, who are Sean Donnelly and Mark Norman, who I did stand-up with back in the day. And I was like, hey, here's this little offer. How much should I like do for the gig or whatever? And Sean, they're both very helpful. And Sean, you know, and what was great was they were both like, hey, cool, let's like talk through the, like, this is what you should get, this is whatever. Sean was like, you know, you should ask for this much, whatever. And separately, Mark was like, I don't know, throw out a first number like this. I don't know, throw like this. I do a terrible Mark impression. But it was just funny because I had to be like, Mark, give me a number that you would ask for if you weren't who you are now. You know, like if imagine back in the day, you know, when, you know, because basically the number he would want is like 50 times what they offered. I was like, I can't, that's not realistic. It was just funny to sort of walk through the, like, just imagine if you weren't a huge success like you are right now.
Yeah. Let's just step back a few years in your career, yeah, and then give me what you want.
Yeah. But also, we were talking, I can't remember if we were recording or not, but we were, yeah, talking about, like, how there's drama in the stand-up world.
Yeah, yeah.
But I feel when you get more successful, I have found less drama. And my friends who are, like, so successful stand-ups, they seem to be like the most helpful of all.
Mm-hmm. I feel like with that, you see the drama more at the open mic level and within scenes, you know, like when people get really attached to a particular comedy scene.
Yes.
You start seeing
the stakes get real high based on very small venues or shows,
yep,
or you were slighted at this one thing or whatever. And it's like, it's so early on the journey, and it's so small compared to presumably what we would all want, you know, at a bigger level. Like, you shouldn't be worrying about the mic that you got bumped from at your small town.
Yeah, absolutely.
Show.
Should just be thinking about, still, well, I got bumped here, where can I go to get,
yeah, I mean,
getting better? You know, I mean, not in a bad way, I'm just saying, yeah, focus on getting better.
Also,
know?
What I realized during this podcast is I've moved into the phase of my career where now I'm just, like, giving advice to people, which is new for me.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because one thing that I found, because I've been involved in some drama, not by choice. It's like, I'm not trying to, you know, mm-hmm, be involved with that. I've got better things to worry about, because we were talking about that before we started recording. But I find that, you know, people will ask for advice, don't take the advice, which is fine. That's their choice. And then get mad, or, you know, it's like, you just want to be like, well, try to tell you.
Well,
try to give you advice.
So here's something that is like, I don't have many emotional triggers, but one of them is the snow. So this is a rough weekend.
So what he's saying is, we have drama. He hates me because I got him to come to Snow Gen Con.
No, I don't. So I don't have many emotional triggers, but one that I have identified fairly recently, and obviously I should work through this with a therapist rather than on a podcast. But
well, sometimes this is podcast. Yeah, very,
I mean, my therapist they run a podcast. but no, like, one thing that I that is specifically, like, upsets me is if I is, like, not being listened to, and this, believe me, this goes way back to, like, my parents. So I have an issue, and I've stopped doing this more. But, like, for a while, I was in a group of comics, friends, social scene, where, like, it was just very acceptable for us to, if you do a set, I'll be like, hey, can I pitch you a little tag for that joke or whatever? And we were very collaborative in that way,
yeah,
which is great. I love that.
I think that's awesome.
And I love getting, like, you know, feedback from people, or if they and honestly, I'll take it from anybody because I don't have to use it, you know. So
yeah,
you
that's
know.
The way I've always looked at it.
Right.
I mean, people, if they want to offer advice,
yeah,
it's like, whatever.
But I ran into a couple situations recently where I, you know, and I've done it with people that I don't know. I don't go like, you know what you should do? I literally will say, you know, I have an idea for this. Do you want to hear it or not? Whatever. And I just got, like, negative reactions from a few people from even, like, the pitching, even asking that, you know,
mm-hmm,
that made me, you were talking about, like, I forgot, drama, or either drama or, like, helping people or something. And
yeah,
I was just like, that is one thing that if you want me to pitch you a tag for your set, I'll have one.
But you need to ask me now.
Well, I got burned a couple times where I felt like it made me feel like I was imposing or intruding on them in a way that wasn't, I just didn't feel good to me. And all I'm doing is just like, hey, I think structurally this thing could have another little thing, or you could tie this to that, or, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of ego that goes into art. Yeah. Feel like there's a lot of egos around. And it's funny because there's so many there's comics that'll get so mad about that. Even at the asking if it's okay to pitch something, and they'll get all offended.
Well,
it's like,
the thing is, I mean, there's ego for me, too, because I'm like, how dare you not listen to my amazing tag, which is always a good idea. Like, the tags always work. No. No, like, there's that, and there's the sense, maybe they react to the sense of, like, why are you watching, judging my set, you know? Like, maybe that is, because that I mean, that's a real thing when you go to do shows and other comics are there, and you're like, are they actually, there's the thing we say of, like, nobody cares about what your set is, you know, mm-hmm. no one's judging you, just work on yourself. But that's, like, not really true.
Yeah. I mean, literally everybody in the audience is judging you.
Yeah.
Whether you're funny or not.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there's ego on my side, too, in terms of.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got to deal with that, Dan.
Yeah. But it's interesting to me because, you know, like I said, comics will get offended if another comic will offer them help and it's like, or offer an idea. And you should, I feel like we should be more open-minded to that stuff because we can always get better. You know, nobody's ever going to be, I mean, even the greats are still getting better, you know.
Well, I'll pitch comics. Comics, can I pitch you this? something my friend and teacher Jerry Katzman told me, which is that you actually should get used to people pitching stuff for your set. And by the way, when people pitch you stuff, they're never like, you need to give me credit for this or whatever. They're just literally trying to help you with something they saw.
Unless
right?
they're from the audience. If right, they're not right. a comic. Then
if they,
like...
But if they come up, you know, and if they approach you in a cool way after the show and they're like, oh, you know that one joke? I had this idea. The reason you should get comfortable with that is that, okay, I know we're not in this like 80s, 90s paradigm anymore where we do stand up and then Hollywood gives us a development deal and we do mm-hmm. a sitcom called Dan! Exclamation point, and it's about your life or whatever. But there's a lot of situations for us aspirationally where we'll be working in something and there'll be people writing for us. And that is a separate skill of incorporating something somebody wrote for you as your own material.
That's an excellent point.
There's no reason to not get good at that now, you know? And by the way, like the second time you say it, you'll be like, oh yeah, I wrote that.
You'll be taking all the credit.
I remember
anyway.
When I came up with that.
Until you get that big Netflix special and then that comic's like, hey buddy, I better get a writing credit.
Yeah.
I was just going to add, too, when we were talking about, you know, approaching comics with ideas and stuff, as a from their perspective, they should be flattered that another comedian took the time to even watch their set.
Well, that's
the
too. Yeah,
like,
that is true.
I mean, we're it's so easy as comics just to sit in the back of the room or out in the bar and not even watch. And
yeah.
If another comic is actually taking the time to, and not just be in the room but actually watch
yeah.
and listen and think of things that could, you know, a tag.
I think yeah,
that's
I,
like
I never
me,
thought
very
of this.
Flattering.
I never thought of this, but I think you just hit on something, which is that is sort of how it keeps it interesting for me. Because I don't always love, I mean, I've seen a lot of comedy in my life, so it's hard for me. It is hard for me to just sit just as an audience member and
oh,
just be
absolutely.
Like, I'm enjoying it. So it's almost a way for me to honestly, it's a way for me to make it productive for me, too, which is like, let me think about how these jokes are being written.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was on staff for this, quote, you know, TV show and they were like, you need to punch up three of these jokes, how would you do it? Like, that's a way for me to like stay engaged.
Oh, yeah. And that's a good way to exercise that skill and work on that, having that tool, too.
Yeah,
because you're right, because. You know, it's funny, a lot of comedians, the end goal is to, you know, for a majority, it's either to get into acting or get a sitcom or a writing job or whatever, and mm-hmm. those are things you'll need as a writer.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not going to necessarily have that just from doing your own stand-up.
Yeah, you know? I also just want to make a more collegial feel. I think something that I struggle to find in the stand-up world is there are pockets where there's people being good friends to each other. It's just, I think a stand-up could use more of it.
Oh, absolutely. I think about that a lot, actually. I'm like, man, I have, you know, friends, and I have, you know, friends outside of comedy, but I have, you know, it, within comedy, I have friends, but they're not like, you know, I don't have like super close friends. That's one thing I've noticed with, you know, like, because I moved, part of my issue is I moved around a lot, you know, been to different scenes or whatever. So it's harder to like establish long lasting relationships, you know, with people if you're not in those areas. And I found when you move to a different scene, people are a little guarded. Because it's like, well, is this a new comic? How long are they going to be around? We don't want to get close, you know, don't want to, you know, build that relationship if they're not going to be around in a month or two or whatever it might be. But I've always been thinking about that. I'm like, God, I wish I had more close, like, comedy people. And when I say close, I mean, like, actually physically close, like, within my, like, where we could go have lunch, do some writing together or whatever. I mean, sure, with the virtual world and social media, you can still be connected to comedy pals all over, but it's still fun to have them to go pal around with and do shows and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and also because the I think Zoom is obviously very useful, but the thing that has been hard during lockdown is that so much of our social connections are... they have to be so intentional. You have to like sit down at your computer and start Zoom, as opposed to you ran into your buddy at Starbucks and then you're like, do you want to go? I need to go to Costco to get this thing. You want to go with me? You know, like that's there's a lot less random social connection, which I think is actually quite important to like these to friendships, you know, or even this. I mean, the it's not quite the same thing, but like even talking on Zoom is not the same as hanging out with somebody at lunch. And
oh, absolutely, you know, not,
it doesn't feel the same.
No, I mean, even like you said, like with a lunch, you do, you know, obviously you plan it because you make the plans to go to lunch, but I doing something over the computer does seem, it seems more formal and more, you know, because it seems more like job like than friendship like.
I think
you
have to put
that extra effort of, like you said, you're logging into your computer, you're getting logged into the Zoom meeting.
Yes, I also think for a lot of people, it's the same, literally the same software that they use to do work with their work colleagues. So that can also, it would be like if you asked your friend to lunch at your corporate day job, like, let's get lunch at the cafeteria at Pfizer.
They have a really killer egg salad sandwich, as long as you get it when they first put it out.
Yeah.
Tuesdays is always the freshest. Oh, that's so funny. Well, we've been chatting for quite a while, and it's a great conversations, but this podcast is called The Art of Bombing.
Yeah,
shit. Yeah, we gotta also get in a bombing story from you. So I'd love to hear your story of a time.
Well, I was thinking about the one that hurt the most was the time that I bombed and then I quit stand up. So because people ask me how long I've been doing stand up, and I was thinking on the way over here, I'm not sure, by the way, on the way, when I say on the way over here, I mean from three doors down in the hotel lobby as I was trying to wake up. Now I'm thinking people say, how long have you been stand up? I want to say, what kind of answer do you want? Because I've only been doing stand up again since like mid lockdown. So like August 2021 is when I started doing stand up again. However, I first did stand up in like 1996 and was doing it in New York City with my friends that I was talking about, and have had intermittent runs at it over the years. And this time, actually, August 2021 was when I was like, you know what? This is the last time I'm going to try.
I'm going to give it another go.
If I give up this time, or I get whatever, distracted, or, you know, I've gone off the journey for various reasons. If it happens again, I'm not trying again.
Well, with that, real quick, before you get in your story, I'm just curious, because you're also, like I said, we talked about it earlier, that you're an actor, and you've been, you know, very recognizable face from acting. Do you find that, you know, if you get into acting, it's harder to balance going out and doing stand up and then you know, and still trying to do the day acting gigs and things like that, where it's hard to balance? Or
you know, or I want to say yes, but logistically it's just not true. because there's really, you know, I would say if you picked my best year of acting gigs, you know, guys, everyone go look at my IMDb and decide which year you think is the best. Probably 2020 is 20 or 2019. But even in the most busy years that I had doing acting, I maybe worked like if you if you're an actor in movies and television and you work 15 days in 1 year, that's probably a very good year for you.
Oh wow.
Because if I did an episode of Superstore, I would go in for 1 or 2 days. The most I ever did for in 1 week was 3. So it, you know, you can be in a lot of episodes. You can be in 6 episodes and only work 8 days.
Oh wow.
So you know what I'm saying is, like, it's not really putting you off from pursuing stand-up. Yeah.
If it is, it's because you're making excuses not
yes exactly. Yeah. Totally I mean, that is what it is.
Okay, all right, I was just curious, because
so first time around when I was doing stand-up, and this is in like late 90s, it was going, you know, decently well. This was like at the open mic stage, and I'm, you know, making friends, I'm trying to build up some time, and I think I have some pretty good material. And so I got booked for my very first paid stand-up gig, which was at a comedy show in a bar, in a lesbian bar, at sort of like after the Gay Pride March in Brooklyn. So not the main one, but the Brooklyn one. So this was, I want to say, like 12 performers at this show. That's, you go to the Brooklyn Gay Pride March, and then you sort of go into this bar and watch a show. And I'm kind of excited because I'm like, I'm getting paid. This yep. is, now it's all happening. And this is maybe 18 months into it, or 2 years into it the first time around. Cool. Right. Now I'm a pro comic, technically, because I'm getting paid.
Getting paid.
I'm
yep.
getting paid $25.
You made it.
I'm getting $25. To do 6 minutes or something like that, which is also sad because, like, you still get paid $25 sometimes to do stuff.
Yeah, it's almost 20 years later.
Yeah. So anyway, just to wrap up the other thing, it's like, sometimes, so I don't know, sometimes when people say, how long have you been doing it? Do I say, like, 20-something years, or do I say 2? Because people, when people ask you, how long have you been doing it, I'm like, are you asking me because I'm better than you thought I would be, and you want an explanation for, you know, I've been doing it for 20 years, that's why I'm as good as you thought I was? Or are you asking me, like, I've only been doing it 18 months, and that's why I'm as green as you think I am? So I go to this gig, and I'm doing the same jokes that I feel like I've been working, you know, in the 18 months or whatever that I've been working on when I first started. And so, just as an example, I mean, the short of the story is that it didn't go well. Like, I used to have a joke in New York City on the subways. There used to be Chinese vendors that would walk through the subway, and they would just sell a bunch of stuff. They would have, like, you could buy, like, sunscreen or, like, gadgets and toys.
So they just
stuff.
Had like kind of like walking,
yeah, like a roaming peddler type stuff. But they would have toys, and they would always have this little device that was, I think it was like a little LED fan or something, that would have like a spinny toy with lights on it, and it would play. It would go, you'd hit a button, and it would go, and that's kind of how you would know one of them was coming through the train. And so I had a joke back then that was, the premise of it basically was that if somebody was Chinese, that I would always, like, feel an affinity towards them no matter what, you know? So, like, even though most of the time that's annoying for a salesperson to come through the train, as soon as I saw they were Chinese, I would think to myself, you know what? I do need a LED fan that plays London Bridge is Falling Down. And so that was the joke. Obviously, crushes all the time.
Especially now, 20 especially years now, later. Especially now, when 20 that 20 years of perfection.
When that phenomenon doesn't exist, it still crushes. People are like, ah, yes, I've never lived in New York City. I've never heard of this, but the structure of this joke crushes. No, I mean, it was just whatever. But it did okay at the time, because people were on the trains and they knew exactly what I was talking about. So I do that joke early in the set at this gay pride show. And at the end, I say, you know what? I do need an LED fan that plays London Bridge is Falling Down, which is typically when I stop talking and the audience would laugh out of recognition. And at this gay pride show, there's just silence. And then someone goes, why would you need that? And I, you know, with my immense stage chops, I just said, I don't know. I just went on to my next joke. But it was like that. The whole, everything was just taken so literally with no... It was just like I was having a conversation with somebody.
Wow.
With
so
no,
like they didn't
no
have
intent
a sense
for me to
humor.
Be funny.
They were.
Oh. Well, I mean, yeah. So like either they didn't have a sense of humor, but also I didn't have the ability to frame the material in a way that was clear that it was.
That was also
it was a comedy show. But also that show was a sort of mix. It was a variety. So other people someone would come play a song. And I'll just say that, like, I wasn't good enough then to recognize the context of the show because there were a lot of very sincere performers on the show.
Oh.
So, but I was
sometimes
introduced.
Sometimes that can be, well, even if you're introduced as a comedian.
You have to manage it, though.
Yeah, and it can still be hard to
yes.
mix that with heavier stuff, you know.
Right, and also it's gay pride and it's not, so if when you have that mix. In the setting of like people just came from watching the gay pride march or whatever, there can also be a sense of no, we need to like sort of honor everyone's experience, you know, and like take it seriously and not, you know, maybe some people were like, I don't necessarily want to assume that I'm going to laugh at this person's jokes because, you know, you can get yourself in trouble sometimes when you take everything like, oh, you're kidding, right? Oh, no, you are. You are a pup and now and you belong to someone else and whatever. That's a window into my world, Dan.
I figured. Yeah. I'm following along.
So then it ends. It goes very badly. And then I'm sort of just in the back sort of being like distressed about how poorly it went. I'm sorry. I forgot to mention that during my set, because it was going whatever, people just started talking.
Oh, no. Just were like, we're done. We're checked out.
Yeah, and it's and by the way, I also hate shows that are in bars when it's not necessarily 100% of the bar is paying attention to you.
Absolutely.
When it leaks from you're doing a show and then the back half is like some people watching your show and then there's another layer that's like,
just
we're
there to
not,
hang out.
We're not watching the show at all. Yeah. We have our backs turned to you. In fact, we're the people that want them to put the game on the television so we can watch it. So it was also that. So, but people were in the back talking, which doesn't help your confidence when there's no laughs and you can hear someone's conversation in the back. So anyway, my set's done and I go sit sort of where those people are. Then someone is doing a spoken word, poem about their life. Coming out of the closet or something like that. And I am not talking extremely loud, but I'm just talking about something. I don't remember what in the back area of this bar after my set went really poorly. And then the host of the show, they come up to me and they're like, shushed me aggressively because the spoken word thing is happening. And I was so offended because I thought you could have also been doing audience management when I was up there. I mean, I didn't think of it this way. I was just annoyed because, like, you didn't shush the people when I was up there. And now when they're up there, you're shushing me or whatever. And then they handed me $25.
And you're so, like, at least I still got paid.
Well, so I still got paid, right? But it just left me with such a bad taste in my mouth. And at that time, I wasn't resilient enough to think, you know what? I should just go do a mic somewhere else right now. Let me put some sets in between me and this set right now. I basically stewed on that set and I didn't do stand up again for like meaningfully for like 2 years after that.
Oh, wow.
Like it knocked me back in a way that was, you know, I was very disheartening. The fact that the set didn't go well and then all of the bad feeling around the set, I had a certain amount of momentum, and I think that's something that I'm trying to remember now is like, I just, sometimes I just need to keep up momentum, even if things aren't going like the necessarily the way I want them to go. Because if you let a certain amount of time go by without doing it, it's hard to start again. So I think at the time I was like, you know what, I'm just going to take a break for a month or something. Let me work on my stuff or whatever. And then you just don't.
And you just don't go. Yeah.
And then that can turn into like 2 or 3 years where you didn't do it.
Oh, absolutely.
Like very easily. Yeah. And I think that I'm trying to remember that I think the momentum works both directions. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you can also benefit from just sort of showing up repeatedly. And hopefully that'll keep the momentum going in that direction as well. But the momentum of I'm just going to stay at home and not go out tonight and try to do a set, that can and actually to our discussion earlier, maybe that is why people want to grind so
as
many
much.
Sets
They're
in a
afraid
week.
That if they stop.
Yeah.
They
I mean, that's a reasonable fear.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
Because I think that's the worst I've bombed, but also I thought of that story because of the impact it had on my career.
Oh, absolutely. very impactful.
And I shouldn't have let it have that impact on my career, but I was also young enough that I didn't quite understand. I think if I could talk to myself now, I'd just be like, just go do 3 sets somewhere else. And also I think that I now
you're like, let's just take this $25 and get a ticket on the bus to another club. Spend this money to get me to another spot.
And I think that also now I would say it really doesn't matter that it didn't go well.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think I was also there was a lot of stuff wrapped in it where I was like, now I'm getting paid. Like I got paid for the first time I ever got paid, and it went terribly. So this person who is a person that pays comics, so they're obviously the only gatekeeper to professional stand-up, you know.
And it's easy to think that when you're so new.
Yeah,
too.
And they have like personally come up and told me to be quiet. Actually, you know what I said? You know, actually, this is such a good therapy session, Dan.
You're welcome.
When I think back to the thought of being triggered by like people not listening to me. So this is my first gig ever where I got paid, and a professional booker or whatever came and shushed me. That is symbolically like a tough thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is definitely something that has, like I said, it has a lasting impact and something that it's like, oh, I do have to work through this because that.
Yeah. I just
so you hired me to talk and then you told me to shut up.
I just worked through it just now, like literally right now.
And there won't be no stopping you now. No, you're going to be going full into comedy and nothing's going
to
stop.
Well, I mean, the thing that I do hold close to me this time around is that, and by the way, when I say that I started and quit, like that's happened. I've started and quit. This is probably my fourth time.
Yeah.
But the thing I'm holding this time is that none of this matters.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
If you bomb, it doesn't matter.
Not at all. I think somebody did just
take a quick time out.
Yep.
I'll leave it record.
Mark this. 44 minutes in. Might have been housekeeping.
Oh. Oh yeah, no, I'm not checked. I'm here all weekend, so I don't need housekeeping. Thank you.
Yeah, did you just get in yesterday?
Yeah.
If you needed housekeeping after one day, that would be. You would have done a number.
Right? They would have asked me to leave.
All right, well, we're still recording. Yeah, just interrupted by housekeeping. That's kind of funny because also there was a do not disturb sign on my door.
Exactly. So it clearly means nothing.
That's right. Signs don't stop people from anything.
Yeah.
You can put any kind of a sign on a door. It doesn't matter. Signs don't stop people.
Well,
but
I mean,
anyway.
you probably have learned that from running this kind of stuff. But, you know, also you emailing somebody like, hey, this is what we're doing. People will still be like, oh, I never heard that. I didn't know I'm not supposed to do this or that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You run into that all the time. People not paying attention or listening. Or, you know, what I found, my experience, especially with comics, is that they're in running big things like this, is that they'll scan emails and not really read the detail. They're just like, beep, 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 looking for whatever, but it doesn't register because they're just scanning.
Something I read in an email recently that I thought was very smart was it was an email like that, and at the top in bold, it was like, if you only remember this from this email, it's this. And it was, you know, the show up at this place for this shuttle pickup at 7:30. Like, it was just like,
they were just
you
like,
need
we're
to know this.
This is what you need to know. Make sure this. If you screw this up, you're on your own. Maybe I'll need to take that note. Speaking of suggestions, maybe I need to do that with my emails.
Yeah.
That I send them out. So people get them. Now, I know, obviously, I mean, you've thought about this for the last 20 years and how it impacted you. You were talking about, you know, you've started stand-up, quit for a little bit, got back into it. With that, like, that kind of a thing, and even now, if you have a set that doesn't go quite as well as you want, how do you analyze it? Like, what do you try to do to, you know, work through it so it doesn't happen again?
It depends on what was the material in that set, because some material that I have, I guess I'll answer that by saying, I think a lot of times it's not so much the material. I do think that comics focus maybe a little too much on, I got to get this one joke written in a certain way that it will be bulletproof, which is possible. But the reason I bring this up is, like, if I have a set where I did, like, my regular, like, where I did a 6 minutes that I'm very confident in, it probably wasn't the material, because, like, the material has worked a lot before. It was probably something else. So I will listen sometimes back to I don't listen back enough, as much as I should, to the sets that I record.
Me either.
You know what? That could be a way to just quickly comics should put on their resumes the ratio of how many recordings you make to how many you listen to. So on your phone, we look at your phone on your voice memo app, and for every 100 voice memos that you've made, whatever that percentage is, that's how good of a comic you are.
That's how we base comedy, yeah. Like the level of a comic. And, you know, that's not far off, because I feel like, you know, people who are in that 90%+
yeah.
are probably going to be really good comics.
Yeah.
That or they're oblivious.
Actually, I think if you're a person that listens to 90% of your sets and you're just a functioning human being that can recognize when stuff was working or not, I think you will either soon be a very, very good comic, or you will... You should recognize after a while, you're like, maybe this isn't for me.
Yeah, exactly. There should be some kind of self-awareness within that, whether it's for the positive or the
So I just bring that up because I think sometimes it's not the material so much as there was something about the context or the way – here's the thing is, I think if you have a healthy relationship with the audience, then it's harder to bomb. You know, if you have a good relationship with that night's audience – even if a joke doesn't work, it can still be fine. You can still have it can still be a fun moment for the audience, even if the joke doesn't. I mean, obviously, like, Johnny Carson proved that for years, that he had this specific relationship to the audience that the material didn't matter that much.
Yeah.
In fact, if the material sucked, he would just be like, he would just live in that moment, right? So I think sometimes a bomb will happen because sometimes it's literally like a logistical thing that you didn't know about that when you record you listen back, you're like, oh, the mic didn't work for the first half of this joke. Literally nobody heard this thing. And then I almost want to say this is like a generic proclamation that I'll test over the next 10 years if this is true or not. But I almost feel like the bomb happens when there's a disconnect between you and the audience. Because I feel like if you're able to be totally authentic with what is literally happening in the room that night, at that moment, I think that can almost maybe make your sets bomb-proof. Whereas, because when we're watching stand-up sets and people bomb, I feel like a lot of times it's like they think something's happening that's not. Mm-hmm. Either they think that joke was funnier than we thought it was, and they want to like berate us for like, screw you. That was funny. That joke works all the place. There's a disconnect there. Or sometimes there's a, like, the last comic did a joke on the exact same topic and you didn't realize that. So there's a disconnect there.
My favorite thing is when especially related to that with crowd work.
Yeah.
When a comic will do some crowd work.
To the same people.
To somebody, and then another comic comes later and does the same exact crowd work.
Yes.
To the same exact people. Yes. And then they wonder why it's not working.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. That's my theory. Everyone go test it out. Because I've done improv, long-form improv, all this time. So mm-hmm. I was doing long form improv around the same time that I started doing stand up, except I never quit doing long form improv. So if you ask me how long I've been doing long form improv, I will say 25 years. And for long form improv, the corollary of this theory is if there's an improv show and the audience sees the show and the audience can say, wow, that show totally made sense. I understood everything that happened in it. The audience is never like, I understood everything that happened in the show, but it was terrible. It wasn't funny. It's always because the audience is like, wait, what is going on? Or the improvisers are not on the same page with each other.
Yeah.
There's confusion. There's always some disconnect between them. And this is my stand-up version of that, which is I think there's only two scene partners in a stand-up show. It's you and the audience.
Yep.
And if you're disconnected from the audience in some way, whether that's your fault, I mean, if the audience is super drunk, they're disconnected from you in that way too. And then you can bomb, like, and then that's not really your fault. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're bringing up a very good point that I think you're right that, you know, we solve bombing. Just don't disconnect.
Yeah, yeah.
We solved the problem.
Well, I think what you see.
But seriously though, I think you're right. There is that disconnect, because it can be even environmental too. You know, like you said, if the microphone doesn't work or something happens in the back of the room, if somebody's talking really loud and you can't hear them, but half the audience can, and things like that.
It can be
so that's a good point.
It can literally be like there's a dead spot in the lights on the stage,
yep.
And you are standing in it.
And your punchline relies on you do your punchline, but to sell the joke, it relies on a facial expression and they can't see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
You know, another thing about it, presenting the material that I'm learning is that. And the reason why I say I know that, I guess there's two fetishes I think that are currently happening in stand-up. One is how many sets people do in a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other set, the fetishization is when people talk about stand-up, it's always about like, this joke was so funny. Look at the writing in this joke. It's so good. The writing is so good, right? But like, there's a lot of like legendarily hilarious comics where if we write down their joke on paper and I show it to you, you're just like, what? Like,
yeah.
You know, and that's not to discount writing, it's just that there's another 80% of the performance that is not in the writing, mm-hmm. that can also be why you bomb.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that, and it's also not going to show up on your recording. Yep. Although now people bring it in, like, and I'm guilty of this too. People, you go do like a 6-minute set and you like set up an entire like camera studio in the back to record your
film crew with you.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think, I was saying right before housekeeping came that I do also just think bombing, like but bombing doesn't matter. The successes don't really matter either. As I get older, I'm just like, just try to enjoy the moments that you have, and we'll all try to get better. And if we quote make it or don't, it's like none of this shit matters. However, I don't have kids. When people have kids, then it starts mattering more to them. I live in a, you know, I'm relatively consequence free. If all this goes to shit, I'll just like file unemployment.
It'll be fine. Yeah. And I like that though. Yeah. Live in the moment. That's really good advice, you know, because it's easy to get wrapped up and not do that. And I think you're right when you're, you know, like I said, that there's so many different disconnects that can happen. And one of the major things is if you're not living in that moment, even if you say something and it bombs, if you just try to keep moving and ignore it, you automatically are going to create that disconnect from the audience because they're going to be like, do they not know that?
Yeah, and you can
are they not aware?
You can paper over that with some if you bluster to the next, and you get to the point where maybe people forget about it. But you also did you rode over a little speed bump in that case. I will just tell you about like one of my favorite stand-ups in the world did such a high confidence move, which I'm not recommending that I or anyone else do. But Daniel Kitson, who is one of the greatest stand-ups in the world, but he's a British comedian. I saw him do a set at the Edinburgh Fringe, and he told a joke about, I don't remember the actual joke, but it was like, there's a playground and something, something, and like, you know, and that's why no kids show up at this playground or something, whatever it was, right? And it just didn't really get anything. And he kept going on the next thing. And then he just stopped and he was like, why did you not laugh at that? And there's, and he's like, because I've done that 27 days in a row and it's gotten a laugh every time. But it's weird that you guys didn't laugh at that. And then he literally was just asking people, like, what did you not? He's like had a conversation.
He just like started analyzing.
Yeah, like what did you think about that? And so people were talking a little bit. And then he was like, oh, I forgot to tell you that this playground was built across the street from a prison. And then he's like, oh, okay. Like he literally just walked.
He just walked through it.
He was like, in the premise, he forgot to say this thing that made the entire thing work. And then he told it again. And I mean, he told it again. It worked, whatever. But I was like, I can't. He literally just had the confidence to be like, okay. And for me, it was super interesting.
Yeah.
And it was just his, I'm in the moment. Like, what's going on? Like, let's look at that. Let's all as a group, like, analyze.
We got to
like,
figure out what happened.
Also takes his ego out of it slightly of just like, you know what? I know that didn't work. He recognized instantly that it didn't work. It was so cool. It was just like, and then we were all his like collaborators. Like, oh yeah, let's talk about like this thing. And then he fixed it, and then it made so much more sense when you heard the whole premise.
when he did all the whole setup, the punchline was a lot better.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah.
How them set, and that's an easy thing that can happen too. You get so caught up doing, you know, as a comedian, we're always thinking, especially when we're on stage. You know, we're thinking about what's next as we're telling a joke and
yes.
we're getting ahead, and it's easy to like without even thinking about it. Just forget something completely.
Yep.
I've caught myself a lot. I'm pretty notorious for going to do a joke that has a callback and then getting halfway through the joke and remembering that I didn't tell the joke that it's going to call back.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, well, I'm going to have to throw an audible here and figure out what I can do.
So then do you finish the joke?
I've done – no. Unless it's something that'll still hit on its own, because I do have a couple jokes where even if it doesn't have the callback, I can still get to the end.
Yeah,
it'll be funny, but not as funny if it would have called back. Otherwise, I have done a situation where I started telling a joke that relied heavily on a callback,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't do the joke for the callback. And so then I just like kind of threw an audible and brought that joke in and just molded it all together. So I still did a callback, just not as far, you know. Instead of it calling back to 15 minutes ago.
It calls back to 1 second ago.
Yeah, 1 second ago. Yeah, the, I just like incorporate it into that chunk.
Okay, so here's my pitch for you, which is that this is what I would do, and I'm not saying this is good. I'm just telling you where my instincts are, and I want you to try it once in your life, which is when this happens, I want you to tell it. This is what I would do. I would tell it because I don't have the wherewithal to like fold in the other joke. So I would just finish it with the callback and then immediately just say, see, that's a callback to a joke that I forgot to tell earlier.
I've done that, okay. too, because I have got all the way through and realized that, you know, they didn't react like they should. And then I'm like, oh, that's a callback.
Yeah.
It didn't work because I messed that up.
Right.
Well, this has been great. We're going to start wrapping up. I wanted to talk a little bit about writing, because especially coming from improv background, a lot of improv people do a lot of, you know, improv's really good for writing.
Mm.
How do you feel like that impacts your writing as a stand-up? And, like, what's kind of your evolution for a joke? Like, you think of an idea, and then till you'll take it and put it in your act or decide that you need to keep working on it.
I think of a topic and then God gives me the perfect joke and I just say it on stage.
Okay. Sweet.
It's like, have you seen Amadeus?
You got it easy. Yeah. Here.
Okay. So as far as how improv has affected like my writing for stand-up, I don't quite know how it has, except that, I feel very comfortable in like the act outs of jokes, mm-hmm. when when I know what the premise is and I just need to like live in it. And I'm that I don't necessarily write out a ton of that stuff because that's almost like we've had the setup, we've had kind of like the punchline, and then we just kind of get to live in the exploration of like what that punchline looks like mm-hmm. In real life. And then it's like, oh, I've just set up a little play for myself and now I can just act that out. So that's obviously that's been great for that. Other than that, I think improv is mostly helpful, like in the being comfortable on stage mm-hmm. and also be comfortable with things not going exactly the way they should. I have like one of my idols is Gary Shandling. And for me, he was very specifically like didn't word for word write out every joke and didn't. He was sort of like not like Seinfeld in this way, in that he was trying to. This sounds really pretentious, but he was like trying to create like a meditation practice through stand-up in the sense of being in the moment, like we talked about. Mm-hmm. And so he would have his jokes would be, here's the thought I have. I know what the setup and the premise and the punchline, all this stuff is, but I'm not going to dictate word by word how it should be delivered. I'm going to that night have the idea and just try to tell you, the audience, you know, use mm-hmm. that night specifically. I'm going to try to relate this idea to you in the way that it comes out that night. And so I think improv has been helpful for that because I have been trying to do that, mm-hmm. Which I think...
Which, that's an amazing skill.
I think that is... and I would say, I would challenge people to do that. Like, take... I know... Here's the thing is, like, my theory is... Really, Gary Shandling's theory is that by trying to write out the jokes verbatim and deliver them exactly the same way every time, what you're trying to do is you're trying to control your way out of like your fear of the unknown. You're trying to construct this joke so perfectly that it can't go wrong. Mm-hmm. And if you take one of the jokes in your set and you're just like, you know what, I'm just going to try to tell it to people tonight and feel like the structure of the joke is in my bones and it will just inform the way I tell them. That's a way of embracing the fact that you can't control the whole situation. So I think that's how improv has been helpful for me, because improv is the better you are at like improv is an insane thing to do because people pay to watch you, and the best improv is I have no idea what's about to happen. I'm going to step out on stage and you're going to think it was worth paying money for. but the thing is, once you get into that world where your subconscious is just giving you stuff, like it's very addictive. Mm-hmm. And I think that the writing things down so meticulously, it can almost block you from getting to that place. So that's how improv's helped me in the writing of stuff. Like I do write, and I will make a real attempt to like write out like what I think the sort of perfect version of the mm-hmm. joke is. I just don't hold myself to it when I deliver it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You try not to be scripted, essentially. Yeah, like, you've got the script, but there's room to, you know,
yeah,
you know, kind of step out of the bounds or however you want to say that.
Yeah,
which is, and I think that's good for comedians that we to try to do that. Even myself, I know when I first started stand up, I was very scripted. I wrote everything word mm-hmm. for word, and then I tried to basically just recite it on stage.
Yeah,
and then you could see it in my performance that, you know, I look back at some of my older stuff, and you could tell that I was just scripted, and it just wasn't the same. Is it now? I don't physically write a lot. I'll write maybe jot some ideas down or whatever, but
yeah,
I work it, you know, over and over through in my head, so it's still kind of word for word, but I'm a lot more loose now on stage than I was back then.
Also, I think maybe if you guys can, if there's a bold at the top of this email, which is the fire, I would actually say maybe just take it easy on yourself. Don't, you know, you don't need to be so down on yourself from a set that you quit for 2 years, because like I think we've been saying good advice, right? But I also think some of our advice is good for different levels of stand-up.
Because oh, absolutely.
At the beginning, maybe you should write stuff out. Like maybe there isn't a thing of like stand-up should the advice that's going to be really useful for an open micer is not the same as a feature, is not the same for a headline.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? So, and I think sometimes we'll take a thing of like, well, I listened to Bill Burr's podcast and he said you should do this. It's like, well, but you're not at his level.
Yep, so, exactly.
And he also, someone who came up in stand-up even 5 years ago is experiencing a different industry from you. Mm-hmm. You know, the industry's changing so much from, like every 6 months, it seems like it's changing. So somebody who has a Netflix special now probably doesn't have that much useful info for you if you want to have a Netflix special in 10 years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know? That's a really good point.
Netflix is Netflix is not even going to exist in 10 years. It's going to be Tesla streaming.com.
Oh, man. Well, this has been great. I thank you. I got a couple more quick questions.
Yep.
We talk about the bombing. I always love to hear the opposite of that, which mm-hmm. is a favorite gig or one of your best gigs that you've done in your career. What's been one of your favorite gigs that you've done?
The gig that I'm proud of right now, which you can go find on YouTube, which is I did a set at the Laugh After Dark Festival this past fall in the Alt show. And I'll just say that we just applied to this festival – comics applied to this festival, and it wasn't like we were like, you should put me in the Alt showcase.
Yeah, they just put you wherever.
But they just decided that, because the comics that did the show, we were like, why are we in the Alt show?
I did a festival like that too, where I got put on a blue show.
Yeah.
And which is fine, but I tend to be more, I lean more as a more clean comedy
right.
than I do. I'm more, and not even when I say clean, not even like, you know, like squeaky clean. I just don't.
Yeah,
I just don't talk about a lot of dirty things. You know, I wouldn't put me in a blue show.
That's, right.
But I was in a blue show.
So I was going to do this Alt show, and leading up to it, I was like, since it's the Alt show, let me try to do something that would be something you'd see at an indie Alt show in New York or L.A. So I basically wrote up a specific premise for this set that basically, it's a set that I don't really think I can ever do again. So it's on YouTube. It's on Laugh After Dark, Best Alt Set, Chris Grace, or whatever. You can find it. And
just to add to that, Laugh After Dark is, they're killing it with their video production stuff.
The video is so good.
They got, they just released the Las Vegas. They have a series on Amazon Prime. You can rent the episodes or buy the seasons or whatever that
yeah.
you get that festival. They're starting to put out comedy specials now.
Yeah, so Kelsey and Robert from Laughter, their video production is insane. Like, it's so good. It's so good, but also when you get a peek behind the scenes, like, they are taking such little research, not little, but like the bang for the buck that they're getting from the way the video looks is incredible. So anyway, I did this set, and it was just, I'm very proud of it. The reason I'm proud of it is that the set was like on a Thursday, and it was like a Sunday that I was like, you know what? I think I could do this idea for this set. And you know what? Let me just take a little bit of prep, write out a couple ideas, and I think I'm going to try it with the help of my friend Drew. And it was like in my mind, and I never did it. And then I did it on stage, and it worked. So I'm extremely proud of the feeling of like, I had an idea. I did not test it out at all. And they're really, when you see the set, it's like, there's no way for me to have tested whether this would work or not. Just in my mind, I had a hunch, like, I think this would be really funny. And it worked really well. But the process, the confidence it gave me a little bit of like, okay, if I have an idea, I should like at least try to do it. Because there was a lot of me that was like, you know what, I should just do my regular 7 minutes or whatever.
Yep.
That'll be fine. But anyway, I'm really proud of that. I hope people go watch it. I won best alt set for that.
Oh, that's amazing. That's fantastic. And that's a cool thing to be able to do, too, because it goes back to being in the moment, living in the moment, too.
Yeah.
Like, even though you took a couple days to prep, you pretty much were in that moment. You're like, it's a once-in-a-lifetime set. And at that show, the people that were there, that audience, they're getting
yeah.
something that nobody else will get. I mean, you can go watch it on YouTube,
yeah.
but it'll never – or you know wherever they have it posted, but it'll never be the same as experience as it was for that audience right there.
Yeah, I mean –
that's
I'm
awesome.
Extremely inspired by Rory Scovel. Because I saw him in an interview talking about one thing he wants to do is that if he comes to your town and he does 5 shows – he wants to give you a reason to come see all 5 shows. You know, he wants some spontaneity in there. And I don't know if I definitely can't do what he does, which is insane. It's so impressive.
I know.
But
it's really good.
I think like in the like platonic ideal of what our performances are, it would be awesome if every time you did a show, it was a special show that night for those audience members, and it was a one-of-a-kind night that if they come back the next night, it's not going to be that again. That would like be the great thing, right? Now that doesn't scale very well because it means we have to like constantly be writing or, you know, but I do think it's a good thing to aspire to, you know, like I'm about to do a set at this Snow Jam Comedy Festival. And I'm probably going to try to do a magic trick in the middle of it.
And, which should work, considering it's at a magic
shop.
I'm going to buy
a magic trick from the store we're in. I'm going to try to perform it.
I can't wait to see this.
But you know what I mean? Like, and it goes to the thing I was saying about, like, none of this matters is, like, there's a part of me that's like, I know some festivals would be like, no, we booked you based on your tape. You should be doing the stuff that your tape had or whatever. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, we're all just going to be here tonight for this one show. Like, why not try to do something distinctive for the people in that room that night? And so I don't know. I think even if we can't achieve that, I think that's a worthy goal to have.
Oh, that's beautiful. Last thing I'd like to ask, we have the Art of Bombing Get Pumped playlist. It doesn't have to be a song that gets you pumped for comedy specifically, but what's a song that gets you pumped to just gives you energy to do whatever it might be?
I think it's called Reese, R-E-E-C-E.
Reese?
By Ed Rush and Optical, I want to say.
All right. There's
a show in New York City called Sleep No More that is an immersive theater piece. And in the middle of it, there's a rave. And there's a song from it that is so good that I basically had to look. And this is where I saw it back before Shazam. I had to look up like what the song was, and it has a drop in the middle of it that is so good.
Okay, I'm looking it up right now. Let's see. All right, well, this has been great, Chris. Thank you so much for joining me. Where can people find you online? Where you want to direct them?
Instagram or TikTok, you can go to Chris Grace Comedy, and then you can go to chrisgrace.com. And also, if you want to like talk about this kind of stuff, I've started a podcast called The Chris Gray Show that's interviews. It's not really specifically like a heavy comedy podcast, but with it, I started this sort of online community called club.chrisgrace.com. And I do want to talk to other people like their creative projects and stuff and like try to encourage each other to like get stuff done.
Fantastic. Yeah. And if you're in LA, go to the monthly show.
Yeah.
At UCB.
Yeah. This is the new stuff. It's at UCB.
Awesome. Thank you.
It's the Art of Bombing.
Welcome back, Bomb Squad. That was our conversation with Chris Grace. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed having that conversation with Chris.
It didn't show. It didn't show, Dan. You have definitely matured. Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I really had to, you know, I've worked a lot of years to not be that person I was years ago. But believe me, I wanted to fanboy.
All right. Well,
you, here's what you do, though. Here's the trick. I did fanboy, but I did it before we started recording.
Okay. Yeah.
I got it out of the way. He was probably like, oh my God, this weird, creepy fan convinced me to come to his hotel room with the guise of a record a podcast.
Oh, no. Yeah. That's a Netflix special right there, like the podcast killings, and then like some guy records them. Yeah, that's coming.
Oh, yeah, that could be like, yeah, that definitely could. There's a market for that. But this isn't the market for that. No. But it was a great conversation. It was so good to have that conversation with him about comedy because, you know, you really get to see kind of what it is. Like even him as a comedian, he's in that point. We talked about it a little bit at the top, where we're talking about that feature spot where he's at that point where he just kind of wants to be the feature, but he's done enough acting that he can be the headliner and that's what people want him to do. But he doesn't want to do that yet because he doesn't feel, you know, as comfortable. Not that he doesn't feel comfortable and doesn't have the time, but he wants to get that quality. You know, he wants to have a quality hour before he headlines. And I think that is something that's very important to kind of think about. As comedians, we always talk about quantity when it comes to going to mics and shows. It's like, how many shows are you doing? If you're not doing 3 open mics a night for 7 days a week, you're not grinding, blah 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 blah. But how much quality are you getting out of that? You know, like that's something that comics need to think about. You need to think about the quality over the quantity, because if you go do an open mic and this is not not a a false statement. There are times when you can go do an open mic and do 10 to 15 minute sets. If you're just starting comedy, don't recommend it. But, you know, if you've got a little more seasoned practice, you know, if you're a little more seasoned comic, going to some of those open mics, if you can do 15 minutes at an open mic, you're getting, you know, that's the equivalent of 5 3-minute open mics that you're getting in one shot. And if, you know, there's an audience, you're getting that too. Because that was something we talked about, because Chris, he started, it's a booked open mic, if you will. It's more of a showcase, but it's, he has a show that he does in LA now for people to do new material, but to get that longer set. So they're getting more quality out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think if you're not actively walking on stage with goals each time you do so, with a plan for what you're going to work on, you're not developing your material and you're wasting your time. There's something to be said about the quantity of reps as it pertains to getting better and more comfortable on stage. And if that's your goal, then the quantity, as long as you're not drinking yourself catatonic before you walk out there, is a good, that's a good strategy. But if you are really using the mic to leverage more material, I think your advice is great. Go find mics that give you as much time as possible. Mm-hmm. Here in town, I found a few 10 and 15s. They kind of come and go, so it's not a regular place that I go. Anytime I do find that, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to this one as often as I can. Or if it's a weekly showcase that's meant to be new material, which you guys discuss on the show, that's a great opportunity to get in good with that crowd so that you can continue to do longer stuff while you're there, and you'll develop your material faster. And you're right, 1 12, 1 15-minute set to work on new stuff is 3 5-minute open mics that you would have to, you know, individually drive to, pay for, buy drinks at, you know, all those things. So I think the quantity, quality,
that's a good point too that you make there. I talk about quality over quantity when it comes to just like doing the material, you know, but you're adding all these other things, that bringing all these other things to the argument that you don't think about. That's, you know, as far as like parking, you know, when you're in bigger cities, a lot of times you have to pay for parking, you have to find parking, the drinks,
you
like that,
you
that
have to pay to get on stage.
Yeah, that all adds up.
Minimum,
and if you
I always
do that in one spot,
yeah,
where, you know, instead of buying 1 to 2 drinks at 5 open mics, that becomes 10 drinks. You go to 1 open mic where you get 15 minutes. Even if you only have, you know, if you 2 drinks for the whole night, that's still, you're saving a lot of money there by not having to go to so many different open mics. And I also think it's important to think about this too, because a lot of comics, they get in that grind mode. And we've talked about it on this podcast where you go to every open mic and you forget to live life, and then comedy becomes your life, and then your jokes start to show it, because your jokes end up becoming too inside baseball and you're playing more to the back of the room, and then that kind of creates a situation where you're not getting booked as much, because if you're not making an audience, if you don't have the jokes to make an audience laugh, you know, comics aren't paying customers. When you're booking shows, and I'm sure you can agree to this because you're a producer, you're not going to book somebody that's a comics comic unless they can appease an audience too. Because
that's
a comics comic doesn't sell tickets. And it, you know, and with that, crowds are going to leave thinking, oh, well, that was not a great show. And then that looks bad on you because they didn't get the humor.
I go for somebody dependable who's going to show up on time and not stress me out that they're going to be late or not show up. I go with somebody who I know is going to be funny and develops material as if they want to perform at this for a living or a part-time living. Like, you're right. We have comics who are amazing at open mics.
Some
and
of the
making
best
all their friends laugh.
Comedians are comics,
right.
Comics.
And
unfortunately, they just don't sell tickets.
I've made that mistake. A couple of years ago, no names, but I brought a guy out, put him in the middle of the show. I still think he's hilarious, I think he's making me laugh because I'm a comic. Maybe because no one else but that's all right.
And that happened. I mean, that's part of comedy. But again, if you want to be a good comic, you need to live, because that's where you source your material from. So it's not, you know, if you get into that situation where you think, oh, I got to grind. If I'm not getting up every day, I'm not a comedian. Don't let people that's gaslighting to me. Yeah. People are letting you believe that you have to do that to be a comedian. To be a good comedian, you have to have good material. To have good material, you have to have material that's relatable. To have relatable material, you have to go live life like every other regular human. And to do that, you have to take a break from going to every open mic. Definitely get as many reps as you can, but remember to take some of those breaks.
Yep. Good call.
Yeah. I think so too. All right, I think this has been a great episode. Next week we have PJ Johnson on the show. PJ Johnson is part two, essentially, to the going to jail in Wyoming episode with Ryan Bonnell.
Oh boy! All right, yeah. It looks like you can get in trouble for telling jokes in Wyoming, guys.
If you listen to the episode, and if you haven't, I highly recommend you go back, listen to the episode with Ryan Bonnell. He tells a great story about how he ended up in jail in Wyoming. And he talks about the comedian. He talks about PJ Johnson because PJ Johnson went to jail with him. And so now next week we're going to get PJ Johnson's perspective of this same story that Ryan told. So it's a really – it's like a – it's a two-party perspective.
Yeah, but then after that bomb squad, we're going to bring in the police perspective just to see what they think.
That's right. We're taking a road trip to Wyoming. That's amazing. All right. This has been a great episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. You can follow me on social media at DBooblets Comedy. All my upcoming shows are on the DanBooblitzComedy.com. Hopefully, next week, I'm going to talk about this. I'm making my debut at – well, not really my debut. I did the open mic at Comedy Works. And now I'm doing the Up Next showcase at Comedy Works. But by the time this podcast comes out, I would have already done it. So we're going to say that it went well.
Yeah, good job, Dan.
Yeah. All right, where can people find you, Josh?
JoshShirleyComedy.com. All my socials going to roll up to that. And you'll be able to see tour dates. You can subscribe to my newsletter, find out what's going on there. You can go to my Facebook, just throw Josh Shirley Comedy into the search bar there, and you'll see a place where you can become a fan, you can like, and you can win.
All right. And if you haven't already, make sure you subscribe to the podcast and join the Bomb Squad Facebook group. We'll see you next week.
It's the art of bombing.